So a soon-to-be programmer on WJXC with my co-producers on the Prison Voices project, which you can find out more about another time. For the last 2.5 years, I've been part of this incredible team of people working to build a full-power, non-commercial FM community radio station for this amazing area. We'll be broadcasting at 3,300 watts to 78,000 potential listeners in the area, and are planning to launch on the FM dial very, very soon. We will announce a date as soon as possible. This building of the station has been a really powerful process of transformation, of growth, of alliance building for all of us involved. And it promises to be that as well for the communities of Greene and Columbia counties. It is really because of the work of people like Amy Goodman that I was compelled to join in the movement of independent media makers who are struggling to share the stories of people that are far too often silenced, marginalized, stereotyped, and dehumanized, as well as to distribute real information that is often censored, distorted, and otherwise concealed by the corporate media. Amy Goodman is a personal inspiration and hero of mine, as a journalist and as an extremely courageous woman. I'm so honored to have her support of all our efforts here in the Hudson Valley, and your support of WGXC will be what makes it possible for Amy's work and Democracy Now! To be broadcast in our area daily. I'd also like to give a special thanks to PJ Maisano, the owner, the generous and very sweet owner of this beautiful historic theater. Oh my God. And to Keith and Yale, the fabulous and owners of Bell's Cafe, the chefs, for hosting the reception earlier. They donated everything for the radio station, and all the proceeds went to the radio station. And I hope for those of you who weren't there earlier or who were to join us afterward for drinks and food. It's absolutely delicious after the book signing. I'd like to introduce Christina Malasoff, another member of the Founding Radio Council and also an inspiration of mine and an activist in the area whose values and fortitude I truly admire.
Okay, welcome again, everyone. I just want to tell you I'm extremely nervous. I'm not a public speaker, and although I have a big mouth, and I also want to thank everyone for coming out tonight. And I also want to thank Kaya's tireless efforts in organizing not only this fundraiser, but many others. There's so many things that the last week I've been trying to write this thing down, and I don't have a computer, so it's really painful. So much paper wasted. But let me get right to it. WGXE 90.7 FM hands-on radio. That's what we're here about. When we, WGXC, first started going into the community to find out what people wanted to hear on community radio, the number one ask for a program was Democracy Now! And with the recent local elections, that's saying something, considering how conservative an area we're living in. Democracy Now! Has been on the air since 1996 and has expanded its reach ever since. It can be heard on low-power FM, community and college radio stations, and over the internet and on cable, satellite TV. Not cable, but satellite TV. Can't read either because I'm getting older. As a founding council member, and longtime listener to Democracy Now!, I felt that my most important goal being on the WGXC Council was to make sure that Democracy Now! Was included in our programming. Listening to Democracy Now! Is part of the daily routine and rhythm of my life, and as many others. It is now the cornerstone of WGXC's morning news programming and will be aired Monday through Friday, 8 through 9 a.m. once we are on the air. That's great. I'm having a hard time reading my writing. You can be informed about what's going on in the world while drinking your morning tea, changing the baby's diapers, or commuting to work. Democracy now is an unembedded, or as Amy says, we are beholden to no one, quote unquote. That means no corporation, no arm of the military, no government can influence or censor the truth as it is reported. Democracy now is where you will hear some of the experiences of people struggling against the destruction of their land and their environments that sustain them and the environments that sustain them, such as the Ngoni people of the Niger Delta who are battling Shell Petroleum, to the people who suffer the brunt of the British Petroleum oil debacle in the Gulf of Mexico. It is perhaps the only voice of death row prisoners like Mumia Abu-Jamal or Troy Anthony Davis, who are on awaiting or on are looking at execution by the state. It is the voice of dissidents, the disappeared political prisoners from around the world. It is one of the few voices that exposes torture and extraordinary rendition. Democracy Now! Is where you will hear intellectuals from around the world talk about the most pressing issues of our time, such as climate change, privatization of world resources, distribution of wealth and power. You will be able to hear in-depth analysis and possible solutions from people like Vandana Shiva, Arundhati Roy, authors such as Tavis Smiley and Cornel West. I listen. You will hear intellectuals such as Noam Chomsky, and Right Livelihood Award winners such as Manfred Max Neef, an economist, a Brazilian economist, or the recently passed Hermann Scheer, among many others. Democracy Now! Is also the voice of everyday people from communities around the world, such as this community, and their perspective of the effects of war, corrupt governments, and corporate greed on their communities. Democracy Now! Is one of the few news organizations talking about these issues. It is a news program that brings you the facts that are not corrupted by vested power. WGXC Hands On Radio is glad to be able to give the people in our listening range of Columbia and Greene counties the opportunity to find out what is going on in the world simply by tuning in to Democracy Now! Thank you very much.
Thank you, Christina. Next, we'd like to introduce Brian Kehoe, who's a trustee in the Village of Catskill, was elected in March of 2010. He is the only registered member of the Green Party who holds a public office in Greene County. And Brian is a professional city and urban planner, lives in Catskill with his wife and son, is politically focused on environmental stewardship. He is a powerful advocate for environmental preservation, ending sprawl development, and acts as a great ally to Catskill, her citizens, and WGXC. Brian.
Hi. All right. Here we are, right? Who's from Greene County? All right, who's from Columbia? All right, Columbia's louder. Well, I want to welcome Columbia. I want to welcome everyone here. This is a very exciting night, and I say let's welcome our new baby, WGXC Radio. I'm also going to read from a prepared statement. I love tools, and this radio station is a tool. What kind of work do you think that this tool should perform? Each of us will probably have our own answers to that question, because the radio station is a blank slate, and that's a beautiful thing. I hope that the radio program makes us feel uncomfortable and makes us realize how uncomfortable this world is and how beautiful it is. The radio station should make us exclaim, "I didn't know that." The station should provide a supportive space for thinkers of all stripes, for organizers, agitators, a big space for activism that really honors our roots. May WGXC always be a virtual coffee house for everyone in Columbia and Greene County and beyond. My hope for this radio station is that it is an institution that does not shout others down and that does not allow itself to be shouted down. May it accept input from all comers, and may it also call out fascism when it rears its head and tries to silence this radio station. For soon enough, this radio station's purpose and intentions will be challenged. We need to nurture and protect this tool, this community asset. May the radio station always remain el defensor del pueblo, the defender of the people. Fight or flight, right? Well, it looks like we're not about to flee. Should we fight? Thich Nhat Hanh writes this, quote, "When fear and anger has been collective, the situation becomes extremely dangerous for everyone. That is why we have to bring a spiritual dimension to our political life. Is it too much to hope that this radio station will help us become more mindfully aware of our fellow humans and of our fellow species on Earth? Eat your heart out, Fox News." This radio station, this tool, it's sharp. It's neither bent to the right nor the left. It's newly minted and shining with promise. This tool is well made and ready for use. May it always be a tool that provides sustenance to us and to our fellow species. Are there any environmentalists out there? Right on. Let's get proud, people. This is our tool. Speak up and save the earth. May this station be available also to the people who think that hydrofracking may be a good way to bring jobs and income to upstate New York. At this radio station, all sides of a debate should have the opportunity to lay out their beliefs. Let the community decide upon thorough information, not just upon simplistic advertisements or prepackaged ideologies. So what are you going to do with this tool? Do you want to organize your neighborhood? Do you want to challenge your local village trustee? You want to learn about business opportunities? Get detailed commodities pricing and farm weather reports? Record oral histories? Here's your tool. Here's your instrument, your hot rod. Get involved and make it happen. Let's make WGXC the very best rural community radio station in America. And I also hope someone steps up and puts together a first-class bluegrass music station for my benefit. At dinner next door, I had the great pleasure to sit with Carlene Saeed Murphy, who is the director, the co-founder and coordinator of the Haitian Community Development Project, the HCDP, which is based in Columbia County. Carlene is a native of Haiti. She's lived in Columbia County for more than 20 years. And this organization, the Haitian Community Development Project, focuses on servicing the Haitian community in Columbia, Greene, and beyond. It's a very transitory community, apparently. They move around a lot, and they provide services such as literacy, advocacy, immigration help, and translation services. And I know that Carlene understands and appreciates the power of this radio station as a tool, and she will use it well. Carlene was telling me tonight that her organization has been honored twice by very prestigious awards. The first in 2008, the Energy Globe Award, which was awarded in Brussels, and the second in 2009 was the National Award for the Energy Globe Award, and that was awarded in the Czech Republic. Most recently, Carlene was telling me that they, through the help of local activists, the collaboration of a company called Solakwa and the Haitian Community Center, they sent a container, a large container of materials and solar equipment to Haiti for the use of the post-earthquake reconstruction or restoration. So thank you very much for your time. That was my sort of upended introduction to Carlene. Thank you for your time. Thanks for having me, and enjoy the evening. Carlene?
Again, my name is Carlene Said Murphy, SCDP's coordinator. I would like to thank you all for coming this evening to join WGXC members and volunteers in welcoming a very much admired woman, Miss Amy Goodman. I would like to briefly bring your attention to the importance of independent media in our underserved area. Community radio in general is an incredible tool for community organizing in the sense of communities organizing themselves, sharing information, creating dialogues, having a voice, having access to news and information that is otherwise scarce. Community radio is also a forum, a public space, a vehicle to build consciousness, and for neighbors to get to know one another. We are honored to have the support of Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! In the exciting moments of launching a new 2300-watt non-commercial community radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. The project has been in the works for nearly 3 years and is now preparing to get on the air, hopefully by the new year. It will reach over 78,000 potential listeners in New York's Greene and Columbia counties and be broadcasting Democracy Now! Daily and live at 8 a.m. It will be the only radio station airing Democracy Now! For the vast majority of the residents in the listening range, and also online. Democracy Now! Is a national, daily, independent, award-winning news program hosted by Amy and Juan Gonzalez. Pioneering the largest media book collaboration in the U.S., Democracy Now! Is broadcast on Pacifica, for some of you who might have heard it driving around another town, NPR, community and college radio stations on public access, PBS, satellite television, Dish Network, which I used to have, Free Speech TV, Channel 9415, and Link TV, Channel 9410. Direct TV, Free Speech TV, Channel 3448, and Link TV, Channel 375, and on the internet. Democracy Now! Podcast is one of the most popular on the web. Wherever you are, you will have access. An important goal of WGXC is to bring new voices to the air, especially those who are often marginalized or underrepresented. There are a number of incredible programs scheduled to air on WGXC, including shows in Spanish, Haitian Creole, Bangladeshi, Youth One programs, a People's History program, a show for and about the local prison population, shows about agriculture, local history, arts, education, and politics. In accordance with WGXC's goal, headlines from Democracy Now! Will be translated in Haitian Creole for our listeners. This is very important as it will help to diffuse misinformation among our people that causes confusion, division, and hopelessness of ever being able to change the situation of our people. Our involvement with this session as a whole will help to facilitate understanding of our people, the culture, and the history, which is not clear in the minds of most Haitians themselves. This is not to say even to us a balanced view on the issues has been a rare commodity. That's the reason myself and most people that I know rely on Democracy Now! And its report for clarity. It was at the beginning of the war in Iraq I began to appreciate Amy of Democracy Now! For the other perspective the program offered on the war. For some reason, I found myself wanting more of such perspective. As going to war with another country where lives and resources will be lost in a serious issue that requires more serious consideration. Since then, I never left Amy's side. Then came the earthquake that hit Haiti last January 12 of this year. The other news media did bring to us the gruesome pictures of the devastation. They also informed us of the massive efforts that were underway to help the victims. As most all of you know, my older daughter was in Haiti at the time, in addition to having family members still living in the country. So seeing the devastation really affected me. When most Americans in the rest of the world were frantically mobilizing their efforts to help the victims, the news media reported that aid cannot reach most of these people because of poor road conditions and insecurity. Most people will simply accept that as fact, but not if you watch Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! She found a way to reach my mother's hometown of Léogâne, the epicenter of the quake, to interview the locals and to ask other NGOs what's the real reason aid could not reach these people. Now, a few weeks ago, a pandemic of cholera from Haiti hits the airwaves. No one told us that the strain of this disease was found to be the same strain that was affected people of Nepal and that waste from the Nepal soldiers stationed at UN headquarters in the area had been dumped in the main river that flows through the region where the victim of cholera live. Again, if you listen to Democracy Now!, you will have found out that poor sanitation and contaminated water is not an issue that has come to view due to the earthquake. Rather, many efforts have been made in the past to address this issue. Money has been promised but not delivered. Then the situation comes to the point where we are now. We hope you will join us to hear Amy speak on the power of independent media as a tool for social justice and help support our work to air Democracy Now! In an area where people demand and deserve to have their voices heard and to hear the stories and information that so rarely makes it to the airwaves. Amy Goodman is an award-winning investigative journalist, syndicated columnist, author, and the host of Democracy Now!, airing on more than 850 public television radio stations worldwide. She is the first journalist to receive the Right Livelihood Award, widely known as the Alternative Nobel Prize, for developing an innovative model of truly independent grassroots political journalism that brings to millions of people the alternative voices that are often excluded by the mainstream media. London newspaper, The Independent, named Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! An inspiration. And political blog Pulse placed Goodman at the top of its 20 top global media figures. Ms. Goodman is the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers. Her latest book, Breaking the Sound Barrier, proves the power of independent journalism in the struggle for a better world. She co-authored the first 3 bestsellers, Standing Up to the Madness in 2008, Static in 2006, and The Exception to the Rulers in 2004, with her brother journalist David Goodman. She writes a weekly column, also produced as an audio podcast, syndicated by King Features, for which She was recognized in 2007 with the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Reporting. This is a great victory for those who know how little independent media exists in this region and how challenging it has been to get Democracy Now aired on local radio stations. The kind of investigative journalism that is inspiring, strengthening, and empowering. Please welcome Ms. Goldman of Democracy Now!
Oh, that's fine. Thank you so much. It's so wonderful to be here. Thanks to the community theater, to the Bell Cafe, and all of you who are making this wonderful, well, what seemed like an impossibility, now a possibility, quite probable, and that is WGXC. Wow. To have a full power FM station in your communities, that is a tremendous accomplishment. Thanks to Carlene for that wonderful introduction. You become a part of the community of media that provides a forum for people to speak for themselves. I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day: war and peace, life and death. And anything less than that is a disservice to, well, when we talk about issues of war and peace, life and death, a disservice to the servicemen and women of this country. Because they can't have these debates on military bases. They rely on us in civilian society to have the discussions that lead to the decisions about whether they are sent to live or die, whether they are sent to kill or be killed. Anything less than that is a disservice to a democratic society. We have just passed the midterm elections, and the column that I wrote yesterday, and none of these columns would be possible without Dennis Moynihan, who edits every column, as well as the book, Breaking the Sound Barrier. In the beginning, we wrote, as the 2010 elections come to a close, the biggest winner of all remains undeclared, the broadcasters. The biggest loser, democracy. These were the most expensive midterm elections in the history of the United States. Close to $4 billion was spent, $3 billion of which went to advertising. What if ad time were free? We hear no debate about this, perhaps because the media corporations are making such a killing by selling campaign ads. Yet the broadcasters are using public property. They are using the public airwaves. Imagine if they didn't have to pay for these jacked up prices all over this country. You wouldn't just have then self-financed millionaires or those who become beholden to corporations or to others because they can't possibly afford otherwise to run. I'm reminded of the 1999 book by media scholar Robert McChesney called Rich Media, Poor Democracy. In it, he writes, broadcasters have little incentive to cover candidates because it's in their interest to force them to publicize their campaigns. Who then defines the narrative, tells the story? It's the ads that let you know about candidates. The Wesleyan Media Project in Connecticut at Wesleyan University tracks political advertising
Following the recent Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, the project notes the airwaves are being saturated with more House and Senate advertising, up 20% and 79% respectively in total airings. Evan Tracy, the founder and president of Campaign Media Analysis Group, predicted in USA Today in July, there's going to be more money than there is airtime to buy. We had John Nichols on Democracy Now! The other day of The Nation magazine. He said that in the genteel earlier days of TV political ads, the broadcasters would never juxtapose an ad for and against a candidate, you know, right next to each other. But they're running out of broadcast real estate. Welcome to the brave new world of multi-billion dollar campaigns. There have been efforts in the past to regulate the airwaves to better serve the public during elections. Like, well, the most ambitious was McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform. During the debate on that landmark legislation, the problem of exorbitant television advertising rates was brought up by Democrats and Republicans. Nevada Senator John Ensign, a Republican, lamented, "The broadcasters used to dread campaigns because that was the time of year they made the least amount of money because of this lower unit rate. Now it's one of their favorite times of the year because it's actually one of their highest profit margin times of the year." So ultimately, to get the bill passed, though, the public airtime provisions were dropped because McCain and Feingold knew that everything else was controversial about campaign finance reform. And if they tried to get the ad time free on TV stations, who was going to be covering the McCain-Feingold bill, putting their spin on it? Well, the very stations that would lose money, and they knew then they would lose. So they compromised by dropping that aspect of the bill. Well, the Citizens United ruling effectively neutralized McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform. One can only imagine what the cost of the 2012 election cycle is going to be. So $4 billion this past week came to $4 billion, the most money ever spent in midterm elections. The presidential election cycle of 2008, I think, was something like $5.3 billion. So you could only imagine what's going to happen in the next 2 years. On the issue of Russ Feingold, of the Feingold, McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform, perhaps one of two most progressive senators, Democrat from Wisconsin, he lost his reelection bid this week to the largely self-financed multimillionaire Ron Johnson. The Wall Street Journal editorial page celebrated Feingold's expected loss. The Journal is owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, which also owns Fox TV, and which gave close to $2 million to Republican campaign efforts. Ralph Nader was on Democracy Now! The day before the election. He said the elections have become a commodity, a profit center for these radio and TV stations. He went on, "The public airwaves, as we know, belong to the people, and they're the landlords, and the radio and TV stations are the licensees. They're the tenants, so to speak. They pay no money to the FCC for their annual license. Therefore, it's really quite persuasive. Were we to have a public policy to condition modestly the license to this enormously lucrative control of the public airwaves 24 hours a day by these TV and radio stations, and say part of the reciprocity for controlling this public commons, you have to allow a certain amount of time, free time on radio and TV for ballot qualified candidates. The place where we should be debating even this is in the major media, where most Americans get their news. But the television and radio stations have a profound conflict of interest. Their profits take precedence over our democratic process. I'd like to say stay tuned to the debate, but don't hold your breath. You're not likely to hear this discussed on the Sunday morning talk shows, but you will be able to hear this on WGXA. This and many other issues, because your radio station, WGXC, is not beholden to corporate interests, as Democracy Now! Isn't, as Pacifica Radio isn't. so that when we cover war, we can do it the way we do because we're not brought to you by the weapons manufacturers. When we cover the BP oil spill, we're not brought to you by the oil companies. We're not brought to you by, when we're covering the issue of fracking, by the gas companies. We're not brought to you by the health insurance industry when we're covering health care. We're not brought to you by big pharma, the drug companies. That's a truly independent media. What else would you hear on independent media? Well, I wouldn't think this should just be over public airwaves. Remember, it's not just public television radio that are using public airwaves. They are too. The corporate media is too. It's not just their private property. The company may be, but the airwaves they use are yours. They're the public comments. So a couple weeks ago, oh my gosh, we had Daniel Ellsberg on. I think it was like October 20th. It was a Friday. He was flying out that night to be at the WikiLeaks news conference on Saturday in London, which was announcing the largest military leak in U.S. history. 400,000 documents, something like 390 or so thousand documents were being released. Dan Ellsberg, you remember who Dan Ellsberg is, did a remarkable thing 40 years ago. He released the Pentagon Papers. He slipped them to the New York Times and to the Washington Post. They were, well, the Pentagon Papers were the secret history of U.S. involvement in Vietnam. And Dan Ellsberg was a top Pentagon official, had top security clearance. He was in the Pentagon. He's seeing the protesters outside. He's hearing about people going to jail. And if you ever think, you know, if you're involved in protest, does it make a difference? It certainly made a difference for Dan Ellsberg. Because he started to wonder, if they're out there, what am I doing in here? And, I mean, this was a guy, top security clearance at the Pentagon. And he was thinking in military terms. He was thinking about the soldiers who were being killed, not to mention people on the other side of the earth also, at the target end of the war, the Vietnamese, the Laotians, the Cambodians. And he had something in his safe. He had the secret history, this war archive. And he had the key. He knew the combination. And so he opened the safe and he decided to Xerox. He said, we didn't have the internet then. All of these thousands of pages. In fact, he would go to a Xerox machine and bring his little kids, because he thought he would be charged with treason, could face the rest of his life in prison. And he wanted his kids to know what he was doing and didn't want the media to frame the story and frame him. He wanted them to understand, to be able to reflect back. And he also wanted to spend some time with them if, in fact, he was going to end up in jail. And so he Xeroxed these thousands of pages. And he got them to the Times. By the way, they didn't print them for months. He started to wonder if they were going to do it. He gave a secret other copy to Howard and Roz Zinn and had them hide it in their house in Boston. You know, Howard Zinn, the great historian who wrote People's History of the United States. And Dan went underground. He and his wife, Patricia, actually were then having dinner and going out to a movie with the Zinns in Boston. They came back to their house, to the Zinn's house. They turned on TV and they saw their house being raided by federal authorities on television. They knew they were in serious trouble. They were on the run. But they felt this was the patriotic thing to do. And they released the papers, and finally the New York Times published them. And I don't know if you know this story, but his deal for giving it to the Washington Post, Ben Bagdikian was an editor at the Washington Post at the time, was that the Washington Post would have to give it to a senator. He tried to get it to a number of the anti-war senators. They wouldn't take the document, but he then called Alaska Senator Mike Gravel. You remember Mike Gravel, who ran for president recently? Well, he was an Alaska senator at the time, and someone said he was quite opposed to the war and probably would consider taking this report and reading it into the congressional record. And he reached him, and he said he would. So that was the deal for the Washington Post to get the papers. Ben Bagdikian would have to get it to Senator Gravel. He agreed. And a couple of years ago, I had this rare opportunity to moderate a discussion in Portland, Oregon, before 5,000 UUs, right, Unitarian Universalists, who are celebrating I think it was the 150th anniversary of the Beacon Press, which is a Unitarian's press, a really proud publication. Most people know the story of the New York Times, Washington Post, and other newspapers publishing the Pentagon Papers. Most don't know the story of this brave independent press that published the entire Pentagon Papers. They were harassed by the FBI for years. They were almost put under. Even the whole Unitarian Church was extremely threatened by this. And this day in Portland, I was moderating a discussion with Dan Ellsberg, Robert West, who is president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, which made him head of the Beacon Press, and Mike Gravel. And they actually weren't planning to tell this story. But as I flew across the country and read more about it, I thought, this is such a rare moment. These three men together. And when I came to the convention center, I said to Dan Ellsberg, okay, so I want you to tell. He said, no, I don't want. They all know that story. I want to talk about what's happening now. I want to ensure that there are people who will leak documents today to end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He never rests on his laurels. I said, Dan, we could do that, but you got to tell this story first. He said, but everyone knows. I said, I don't think they know as much as you think. We certainly know the Pentagon Papers, but what that little buzzword, especially for young people, what does it mean to be involved in the decisions where you come to this turning point in your life? And, you know, then the event was beginning and he was arguing with me and they called me up to the stage. So I said, today, we're going to talk in this rare moment where three men were intimately involved some 35 years ago with the release of the Pentagon Papers about the history. And then Dan Ellsberg will talk about what he wants to see happen. He gets up and he says, I am not here, but now that you've been told what I'm going to say, okay, I'll tell it very briefly. And then he held forth and it was spellbinding because this is why your station, WGXC, and all the stations in this country that are independent are so important, commercial free, because they provide a forum for people to speak for themselves, to tell their own stories. As journalists, that's all we are, is storytellers. Telling, first, most important, is you telling your own story. But when someone can't tell their story, when they've been detained, when they've been disappeared, we must tell their stories until they can tell their own or someone else who knows them can. It's the handing down a kind of oral history that will make the biggest difference. People speaking in their own voices. You know, that's the power of Pacifica Radio, of WBAI in New York, of KPFA and Berkeley, KPFK in Los Angeles, KPFT in Houston, WPFW in Washington, the five stations of Pacifica. Pacifica founded in 1949 by a man named Lou Hill, who was a conscientious objector when he came out of the detention camps in 1949. He said, there's got to be a media outlet that is not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica was born. The first station, KPFA in Berkeley, went on the air in 1949. It wasn't a very auspicious beginning because FM was in its infancy. And so they had to give out a radio that could hear the broadcast. It was called the subscriber. You get this little box and you turn it on and you'd hear people begging for money. It didn't bode well. And yet, 10 years later in 59, KPFK in Los Angeles goes on the air in 1960, BAI celebrating its golden anniversary now, 50 years. Then Houston, KPFT, 40 years now, 1970, and KPF and WPFW in Washington went on the air in 1977. And it was the model for all public radio and television in this country, listener sponsorship. And it continues to this day. And so I not only look forward to Democracy Now! Broadcasting over the airwaves of GXC, but of joining you in pitching on the station to ensure that you all also contribute, because there's nothing more profound. That is what People's Radio is all about. I mean, let's think back to the beginning of KPFT. I was just pitching on KPFT, you know, talking about its Ruby anniversary 40 years ago in 1970. Aren't you going to look forward to 2050 talking about your 40th anniversary? So KPFT went on the air in the spring of 1970. It was on the air for a few months, and then it was blown to smithereens by the Ku Klux Klan, the only station in the country to be blown up. Its transmitter, they wrapped dynamite around the base of the transmitter and blew it up. The silver lining was they obviously didn't have enough money for advertising, and it certainly blew it into the consciousness of the potential listening audience of Houston. And then they got back on their feet, and they went on the air, and the Klan blew it up again. I think Arlo Guthrie was in the midst of singing Alice's Restaurant when it was blown to smithereens again. I can't remember if it was the Grand Dragon or the Exalted Cyclops. I often confuse their titles. But he said it was his proudest act. And I think that's because he understood how dangerous independent media is. Dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, whether it's a child in Gaza or an Israeli grandmother, whether it's an uncle in Afghanistan or an aunt in Iraq, or a child who lives under the shadow of the flame in Ken Sarawiwa Zagoni land because Shell burned off the gas, not allowed in this country. There's nothing more powerful, and it challenges and breaks down the stereotypes and caricatures that fuel the hate groups. And I can tell you that today, there is nothing more important now in challenging what we see as a very frightening trend in this country. When people start to lose everything, they have less stake in the system, and they can go many different ways. They can join together, or they can attack. When we were in Bonn, Germany, you know, earlier, Manfred Max Neef was mentioned, an amazing Chilean economist who we had on. We went to cover the gathering of the Right Livelihood Awards in Bonn, Germany, and more than 75 of the laureates were there, people from all over the world. You know, Wangari Maathai won one of these and then won the Nobel Prize. Maud Barlow won Right Livelihood Award, and Manfred Max Neef won. And I never heard of Manfred Max Neef, but he was there, and very, very tall guy. And he had come from Chile, and he developed this theory of barefoot economics. He said, you know, he was this highfalutin UC Berkeley economist, and he, though, was traveling through Latin America. His specialty was poverty, and he found himself in the Sierras in Peru. And he was in a slum. It was been pouring rain all day. He was standing in the mud across from a scrawny guy, very thin, wiry man, father of five, with a mother and a grandmother he was supporting. And he looked at this man and thought, I have no language to talk to this man. Oh, they both spoke Spanish. But he is an economist. He said, what can I say? Don't worry, the GDP has gone up 5%. He said he realized he had nothing to say to him. And he stepped back and he started to develop this whole theory of barefoot economics. He said it's a metaphor that he have to be in it to understand it. He said it's like love. You can describe it. You could study it from a biological, physiological, psychological point of view. He said we understand so much, but we comprehend so little. And he said, I started to stay there, to live there, to eat with the people there, and I started to understand. He said, to listen to people talk, he said, you cannot be an idiot and survive in a slum. It takes tremendous ingenuity. I think of the Haitians, the tens of thousands of Haitians who remain displaced. 1.8 Haitians of 10 million population are displaced in camps all over Haiti. 300,000 died as a result of the earthquake. last January 12th. What does it mean? You know, me and my colleagues from Democracy Now! Went down after the earthquake, then we went 6 months later back, and there are the same people in these camps that now, right now, are facing more flooding and another hurricane season. What does it take to survive? As I stood in these camps, I thought, could I do this? The ingenuity, the creativity, the intelligence, and he said, the community and the solidarity, what you need to get by. All things that are antithetical to our individualistic society today. And that's the power of this one man talking, sharing his story of his transformation. And we played it on the radio and on television, and people, the response has just been quite remarkable. People telling their own stories. And when we were in Germany, it was there. And my colleague, Anjali Kamet, just went to Austria for a conference of community media called Elevate. And she found the same thing. It was there that people were most alarmed. They kept saying to me in Germany, what is this Tea Party movement? Is it what it feels like? Should we be as concerned as we feel? More than anywhere, they were saying this in Germany. People can go in different directions. I mean, in some cases, it really is a grassroots movement. It came from people's alarm and anger, seeing the Obama administration bail out these mega billion-dollar banks with taxpayer money, taxpayers who were losing their own homes, and they were bailing out the banks that were foreclosing on them. And they didn't even have the note to show that they actually own the mortgage. And so all of these fraudulent foreclosures are now being exposed. And people are saying, wait, who is this government representing? And it makes sense that people were asking profound questions and completely disoriented and disillusioned and angry. Is this the change that either we voted for or even if they didn't, that people voted for? And so this movement started to churn. And the question is, well, a whole portion of it now co-opted by the billionaire brothers like the Koch brothers, right? Charles and David Koch, you'll see their names. David Koch at Lincoln Center, Performing Arts Center. They pour millions, perhaps billions, into the arts and into this Tea Party activist movement. I dare say they wouldn't have tea with any of those people and never have. But it's destabilizing, and they weren't happy with the direction of the country. In fact, some Tea Party activist leaders have quit the movement. They said, this is not what we began. It is not supposed to be taken over by billionaires who have a completely different agenda. So the media, in covering movements, is extremely selective. I think back to March of 2010, the anniversary of the war in Iraq. It was like March 19th, March 20th. Maybe some of you were in Washington. There was a big anti-war protest of thousands. There was also a Tea Party protest, and there were a couple hundred people. I think there were more journalists covering them than there were Tea Party activists who were actually there. But when it came to the anti-war protest, very little coverage, and it was many times larger. And it matters. You know, whose voices get amplified? And people desperate in the country looking for solutions, they hear one group of people rising up, so they seek them out. We need a media that covers movements. My brother David and I our second book was called Static, Government Liars, Media Cheerleaders, and the People Who Love Them. And we called it Static because in this high-tech digital age with high-definition television and digital radio, still all we ever get is static. That veil of distortion and lies and misrepresentations and half-truths that obscure reality. Well, what we need is the media to give us the dictionary definition of static: criticism, opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. The media denigrates activists. We have to challenge the corporate media, because don't forget, they're using our airwaves too, and we have to build our own media, which is exactly what WGXC is doing and why I'm so proud to be here to help ensure that this station goes on the air as a voice for people here and then online to be heard all over the world. I mean, local voices are so important. And for those local voices dealing with local issues, they have global implications. You think about who we watch on television. That small circle of pundits on all the networks who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. What about going into some of this is just doing the hard work. I mean, the producers of Democracy Now! Work around the clock to really dig down into a story. Who is most affected? Who's at the target end of the policy? Who has the story to tell? Who are the experts in different communities on those issues? And that's why you hear such authentic voices. Unfortunately, they leave us such a wide berth. I mean, there is so much. The corporate media, with all of its resources, does so little to reach out into communities. We shouldn't be as unique as we are, which is why I'm glad WGXC is going on the air, because you just add to the forum for these voices. I see Democracy Now! Connecting the dots of people all over the country, media outlets that where we can hear people speaking, and then linking that with people all over the world. Because there are so many fine Americans who are doing such hard work in their communities. You know, Democracy Now! Airs now on more than 900 stations. It's airing daily in South Africa, on television in Austria, twice a day in Sweden. It's translated into Spanish, the headlines. And if you ever want to learn Spanish, or if you're Spanish-speaking, you want to learn English, you can hear the headlines. You can see them transcribed on our website in English and in Spanish. If you're a Spanish teacher, have the students compare. It's just absolutely amazing. We work with an Uruguayan collective in translating the headlines and recording them every single day. So by the end of the day, the daily headlines are recorded. We broadcast weekly in Japan, and I think they call the show The Other America, and it airs on this sort of equivalent of the New York Times cable station. It's called Asahi Shimbun. That's their newspaper, and they own a cable station, and then Japanese journalists come on afterwards to comment. But, you know, I think it's mainstream America. I think what we call the MSM, the mainstream media, is not mainstream. It doesn't represent mainstream America. Because those who are opposed to war, those who are opposed to torture, are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take it back. The issue of war that is so rarely addressed, I started telling you about WikiLeaks. This historic moment in, I think it was October 21st in London, October 20th, it was the afternoon of Friday. We had Dan Ellsberg in the morning, and he said, I have been waiting for this moment. I have been calling for people to release documents, especially from within the military. It takes great bravery. They do it at great risk to themselves, but it is the only way we will end these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so he was very excited to be going to London. The interview we did with Dan that day, just talking about what was about to happen. I don't know if it's at 800,000 hits right now, the YouTube video. I mean, the response was enormous. Of people interested, because I think information is power. It's where you begin. And I think also why that's why Democracy Now!, which deals with such difficult issues, is not depressing, but actually hopeful. It provides hope, because you don't hear the know-nothing pundits. You hear the analysts or the activists who are deeply knowledgeable and are doing something about these difficult situations. And so when you're trying to figure out what do I do, you can learn about all the different groups and people that are doing something about it. That's its power. So The WikiLeaks release happens. These are not documents written by peace activists about what was happening in Iraq. Because, by the way, this latest document release was all about Iraq. It's the Iraq war logs written by soldiers, by officers and soldiers who are on the ground reporting back every day what they were seeing in Iraq from 2003-04 to 2010, right up until now. Why does it matter? Not just for history, but it's the way we can end war. Let me give you an example. WikiLeaks released some documents a few months ago, and Democracy Now! Aired the video of what they released. Could you imagine if in February of 2007, this is one of the documents that was just released, a description of two Iraqi men who look up in the air and they see a helicopter targeting them, and they put their hands up. They try to surrender. And the soldiers in the Apache Hellfire helicopter call back to their base, and they say, they're not rogue at all, the soldiers. They're asking permission. They're saying, these guys are putting up their hands to the helicopter. And the lawyer back on the base, this is all written in the military document that was just released on October 20th. The lawyer back at the base says, you can't surrender to a helicopter, so they blow them away. So that was in February of 2007. We're learning this now. But imagine if we had learned it then, that if these documents had been exposed then. So here is this unit that blows these two Iraqis on the ground away. There should have been an investigation at the time. And if there had been, perhaps 5 months later, February, March, April, May, June, July, 6 months later, July 12th, 2007. The same helicopter unit, Apache helicopter, is flying over an area of Baghdad called New Baghdad, and they see these men, Iraqis, on the ground. There's a group of them. One of them, by the way, is Namir Nur Eldin, one of the premier videographers, filmmakers, journalists for Reuters. And his driver is Saeed Shema. He's a 40-year-old father of four. And you know what happens when journalists go to an area? People gather around, they want to show them everything in the area, and that is what had happened. And so they're there, and people have gathered around, they want to show them the area. The helicopter comes overhead, and it begins to target the men below. Again, they're not rogue. These young soldiers are calling back to the base constantly. They're asking for permission to, quote, engage. And they blow them away. The entire group of 10 or so people below. And they film it themselves because the Apache helicopter has military video, and this is what was released. This we had before this most recent release because WikiLeaks released this a few months ago. When Saeed and Amir were killed, Reuters, the news agency, desperately tried to find out what happened, and they demanded under the Freedom of Information Act the video, because they know that the helicopters have video, and they were denied over and over. But now they were released. And you see, Saeed is critically wounded, but he's dragging himself away from the bodies, and a van pulls up to help him, to get him into the van, to bring him for medical help. And what you hear in this video, you see them, you see what's happened, and you see the cursing, you hear the cursing and the laughter of the soldiers. Let him just pick up a weapon and we'll blow him away, that guy who's crawling away. Let him pick up something that looks like a weapon and we're gonna. And then the van pulls up, they say permission to engage. There were two kids, by the way, in the van, and they explode the van. And then one of the tanks comes and Namir Nur Eldin is dead, the 22-year-old reporter. And the tank drives over his body, and they start laughing, and they say, hey, we think that was a body down there. It's just gruesome, the videotape. And you know something? We've interviewed a number of the soldiers who were part of that unit. They are sick now, some of them. I mean, we haven't interviewed all of them. One young man is slowly killing himself, drinking himself, drugging himself. He had come upon the scene. He's part of the same unit, but he wasn't in the plane. He was in the he was on the ground. He raced up to the van, which they'd blown up, and the two kids were in there. They weren't killed, but they were critically wounded, and he tried to save them, and he did. He could not get the image out of his head of these kids. Someone had called for them to be brought to the U.S. military hospital. It was denied, and they were sent to an Iraq hospital. Of course, they wouldn't get as much care. But he then went back to his unit, and he immediately asked for psychological help. He could not get these kids out of his head, and they told him to suck it up. And he's come back, and he's having a very, very hard time. Another guy in the unit started to talk, another of the young soldiers, and we had him on. And he was sick that day that the soldiers killed Namir and Saeed, July 12th, 2007. And so he wasn't in the plane. But when they came back, they talked all about it. And he said, what I don't understand, he said, I'm Democracy Now, is why you're choosing this one. Well, because we had videotape of this one. You know, you need the videotape. You need to show the images. He said, because this happens every day. Every day. And you wonder why there are so many sick soldiers coming home. You know, violence begets violence. You know, Joe Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, and Linda Bilmes have written this book called The $3 Trillion War, talking about Iraq, Afghanistan. They said it's actually much more now. They hadn't considered how much help soldiers needed. They say it's well over $3 trillion. So when you hear this cry of deficit, deficit, and how are we going to deal with the deficit so we'll have to cut health care and, you know, get rid of the health care legislation and cut Medicare and Social Security, why isn't the issue of war raised? In talking about what's contributing to the deficit, where are the deficit doves saying, let's cut the budget? What about the Pentagon? And that will save everything and everyone. We know this war in Afghanistan is hopeless, is devastating this country. Ultimately, the U.S. will negotiate with all the parties and pull out. It's just a matter of how many bodies from now that will be. And that's why so many people are disillusioned with President Obama, because they voted him in explicitly on the issue of war. I mean, there really was very little difference between Senator Obama and Senator Clinton, but their positions on war, the war in Iraq, right? She was for it until the very end when she saw it was too late, and he was against it. And I really do feel it was the anti-war movement that swept him into office, and all those across the political spectrum who felt that these wars were wrong. But President Obama, I think, has forgotten that, or has surrounded himself by people, well, who've been there forever, and just as the presidents before and the presidents before. And that not only goes for the issue of war, it goes to the issue of the economy. Right, the Geithners and the Summers, the idea that President Obama could go on Jon Stewart's Daily Show and when asked about Larry Summers say he did a heck of a job, actually not facetiously. And even Jon Stewart looked at him and said, Mr. President, you don't want to say that. It truly is astounding, and people feel betrayed. But you know, it's really not up to him. I think that the millions of people that this community organizer in chief galvanized in 2008 stopped dead in their tracks on November 4th, 2008. They were so amazed at what they had accomplished. And accomplish, they did. I mean, could you imagine if you were in outer space? I think on that night, November 4th, 2008, the world heaved a sigh of relief that you could hear in the heavens. And I mean people across the political spectrum. I mean, the first African-American president in a land with a legacy of slavery, a person who represents such a different path. I mean, for one thing, the community organizer. Right. And interestingly, he was a community organizer, housing organizer on the south side of Chicago. So he knows what's going on with housing. But just think, all over this country, parents are saying to their kids, maybe you can be a community organizer too. You know, that's going to be very good for the generations to come. But what happens when the community organizer in chief becomes the commander in chief? Who does the community organizing? That's up to all of you. That wasn't the end. It was just the beginning, and it's not up to one person. I think people felt for so long they were hitting their heads against a brick wall, and that wall became a door, and the door opened a crack. And the question is, will it be kicked open or slammed shut? And that's not up to one person in the White House. That is up to all of you. When he is sitting in the Oval Office, and those who are used to enjoying power and having the ear of the most powerful person on earth whisper to him, if he can't point out the window of the Oval Office and say, if I do that, they will storm the Bastille. If they're not out there, he's in big trouble. And then there's going to be the times that you are just absolutely diametrically opposed to what he is representing, to the decisions he's making. And you have to decide what you're going to do, because there's no one more than President Obama who understands Frederick Douglass's statement, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and it never will. It's how he's in office today. These are the stories he tells when he goes out on the campaign trail, what he told very late into these midterm elections as he started going out and realizing you can't just attack your base. Right? Here was President Obama saying to the base, the people who supported him, buck up. And there was Vice President Biden saying, stop whining. I have been invited on CNN a number of times now on the John King USA show that airs at 7 Eastern Standard Time in the evenings. And he asks, you know, why do you think President Obama is starting to talk about the civil rights movement, the abolition movement, the women's rights movement? This was leading up to the One Nation March that happened a few weeks ago. I mean, there were well over 100,000 people there, so much bigger than any Tea Party. And yet, what kind of coverage? If you weren't there, you probably didn't even know that thousands of teachers and union activists and environmentalists, I was speaking to a busload of immigrants from Ohio who had come. Some had documents, others did not have papers, some were being deported, and they were describing what was happening in their communities, and people from all over came to voice their concern. Hardly any coverage. And I said to John King, they had never been talked about. It was Friday night, and I was going Saturday morning to cover this march. They hadn't even never mentioned the One Nation March. I said, I think it's because he's realizing he has to talk to his base. They're coming to Washington tomorrow, and they're angry. But it's very late in the game to be doing that. And it's not just about how it's framed, that President Obama's not framing it correctly or who he's talking to. It's about the policy. It's very real. And it's up to the press to reflect what's happening on the ground. You know, the first column in the book, Breaking the Sound Barrier, which is the book of my columns, and by the way, the columns are distributed by King Features, and you can ask your local newspaper to run them. They're a weekly column. And the first one goes back to the eve of the invasion of Iraq, February of 2003, in front of the UN Security Council. You know, this tapestry hung there for decades. It's now being, the UN is being beefed up and renovated, so they took it down, and it's now traveling around the world. But it's this tapestry of the Guernica. You know what the Guernica is, the famous Pablo Picasso painting that he wrote in this flurry of rage. He was in Paris, he comes from Spain, and Franco had risen to power, and the town of Guernica was bombed by the Germans, and Picasso was so wounded, horrified by this, that for 21 days he painted the painting that's come to be known as Guernica, and it has become this famous anti-war symbol. The pain of war etched in the faces of the animals and the humans in this painting. And he said this painting could never return to Spain under Franco. And so he knew it would travel and was afraid it would be destroyed. So he had weavers make three tapestry reproductions of Guernica. And one of them is hung at the in front of the UN Security Council. So at the time of the lead up to the invasion, remember February 5th, 2003, Colin Powell gives his push for war at the UN. He was Secretary of State at the time. It wasn't lost on the US and UN officials that these pro-war statements up against this anti-war painting, well, the irony was a bit too much. So they shrouded the tapestry. Well, with a blue curtain. It's our job to pull that curtain back. And I look forward to all of you doing this on WGXC. To pull that curtain back and show the images of war, the reality on the ground. Show the images. Now, I hear, so another time I was invited on CNN. It was the day that President Obama had been elected, but it was right before the inauguration. And they invited me to come on to comment on the Obamas going to the White House. They were meeting with Bush, the Bushes. And so I went in the afternoon and I was watching the video screen and there was people chattering, you know, on the show. And I see them walking into the White House and I go, oh my God. And they asked me a question not related to it. I said, wait a second, we have to take pause here. We have to take pause. There is Barack Hussein Obama and Michelle LaVon Robinson Obama. You know, her grandfathers came from South Carolina. They are the descendants of slaves. She is the descendant of slaves. So their kids, Sasha and Malia, are the descendants of slaves. And they are entering the White House, which they will soon live in. The most famous house on earth that was built by slaves. Let's just take pause. Can President Obama redeem the White House? It's up to more than him. It's up to everyone. And I thought about a house that's not so far from there, a couple of hours away on the eastern shore of Maryland. It's where Frederick Douglass was born. And, you know, he was enslaved as a youth and a teenager. And he was handed to a guy named Edwin Covey, who was known as the slave breaker. And he would take the troublesome slaves, and it won't surprise you to know Douglass was a troublesome slave. And he was brought to his property, which was called Mount Misery, and he tortured him and he beat him, and Frederick Douglass fought back and he broke away and he came north and he changed the world. In Manhattan, where I live, by the way, our studios we've just built, and our architect was someone who lives here as well, Larry Bagdonow, an amazing architect. And we've built the greenest TV, radio, internet studios in the country. We just got our Leeds Platinum rating, which is awarded by the U.S. Green Buildings Council. The New York Times tried to get platinum and they didn't make it. But it was an amazing experience building the studio, believing that, you know, if we believe in sustainability, the medium is the message, we have to live it. And I invite everyone to come and see it. It's an amazing place in Chelsea. We used to broadcast out of an old firehouse, an amazing community media center in Chinatown. And it was a few blocks from this coffee house I used to go to, an old red brick building. And it had a plaque on the outside that said, this building was the printing press of David Ruggles, who was born a free black man in Connecticut. And it was the refuge for Frederick Douglass when he first came north. And I think that's so interesting. David Ruggles, printing press, Frederick Douglass, the North Star newspaper, both of them saw the media as their means of liberation because information is power. But back to Mount Misery, where Frederick Douglass was tortured. Mount Misery today is owned by Donald Rumsfeld. He bought it in 2003. It's his vacation home. And he's going to sort of resurface soon because he's just written his memoir. But he bought it in 2003 to live near his close friend, the Vice President Dick Cheney. Donald Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense at the time. He owns Mount Misery. And I read this, you know, on the internet, but I did a lot of research and I did see that it was true. Although, you know, I'm a journalist and I really have to see it with my own eyes. By the way, we have to preserve net neutrality. The internet is so important for getting information, for communicating with people. And we have to keep it open and free. We can't let the cable companies and the telecoms write the legislation that would privatize the internet. And especially now, these telecoms, cable companies, their power with the money they've taken in, it's all related. I mean, they're going to have tremendous influence in Washington. They are the most powerful lobby, the telecommunications lobby. And now, as the gearing up already has begun for the presidential election, you have to be very careful about who President Obama will bow to, will be catering to, because the Democrats need this money just like the Republicans. It's a very serious issue. But while we must preserve net neutrality, you also have to remember, and if there are students in the audience, the internet can be a global rumor mill, and you got to be very careful about what you read there. You know, just because it's in print, whether on paper or on the internet, doesn't mean it's true. So you have to double and triple and quadruple check everything you read. So I read this, and I was just totally amazed. And I decided, no, we have to go to St. Michael's, to Maryland, and see if this is true. So Dennis Moynihan and I drove to St. Michael's, and we drive into town. And I realized, I have no idea where the Secretary of Defense lives. So we see this organic coffee shop ahead of us. And I thought, you know, they'll tell the truth. So we go inside, and they said, what would you like? I said, I'd like to know where the Secretary of Defense lives. And they said, oh, that's simple. You just go out back, you drive down the road, you'll hit Mount Pleasant Road. Don't go down that road. And then you make a right and another right, and you'll hit Mount Misery Road. You go to the end of that road, and that's where he lives. So I thought, oh, we're getting closer to the answer here. So we drive down the road. We don't go down Mount Pleasant Road. We make a right, and then we make another right. It seems we couldn't go right enough. But we did hit Mount Misery Road, and we drove down the road. And we see the black-tinted windows of the SUV, the Secret Service, and we know we have arrived. So I get out of the car, and I have my little video camera, and I'm zooming in as they're zooming out. And I'm thinking, does Donald Rumsfeld understand the significance of his property? And as I'm zooming in with my camera, there is a stake in the ground that I see right next to the driveway, and it says Mount Misery. So it's a Sunday morning. We head to this old black church on a dusty road down the road, and I go inside. They're just about to have Mass, and the folks are conducting Sunday school in the sanctuary. And I go up to this woman, and I say, this is just like unbelievable. I said, I wanted to get your comment on this. This is such a historic place. You have Frederick Douglass born here, and he's taken to Mount Misery where he's tortured and he's beaten, and then he escapes, and that property, Mount Misery, is now owned by the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, who's known for torture. What do you make of this? And she looks at me and she says, I can't comment right now. We're in church. Now, from Mount Misery to Mount Hope, I was speaking recently in Geneva, New York. And after I told this story, at the end of the talk, this young woman comes up to me in Rochester, near Rochester. And she says, if you would come with me to Mount Hope Cemetery, I would like to show you Frederick Douglass's grave. I didn't know that's where he was buried. So it was late, and I was catching a very early flight to Denver, where I'm headed to tomorrow as well. And it was in the middle of a snowstorm. And I said, well, if you would meet me at 5 a.m. in front of the cemetery, I'll go with you. And she was waiting in her parka. You could hardly see her. She was covered in snow. And we walked to the tombstone of Frederick Douglass, and we brushed the snow off of it. And it really was amazing. And then she had a twinkle in her eye. Or maybe it was just a snowflake. But She said, would you come with me across the cemetery? I want to show you one more tombstone. And I said, oh my God, I have to get to the airport. And she said, please, it'll just take a second. And we're walking and then we're sliding and we're running and we make it across this vast cemetery. And she shows me the tombstone of Susan B. Anthony, who's buried next to her sister. You know, Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass were not just allies, they were friends. When I told the story at Wesleyan after this, a woman came up and she said, and then did you go to Susan B. Anthony's house? Because right near there is a statue, not of generals, but of Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass having tea together. See, Frederick Douglass, the greatest abolitionist in American history, was also a great feminist. He was at the 1848 Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention. Elizabeth Cady Stanton puts forward the resolution for women's suffrage, which was not generally supported, and he seconded it. He seconded it. He is the reason that was actually put to the people there. And Susan B. Anthony was not just a women's rights activist, a feminist, a suffragist. She was an abolitionist as well. The women's rights movement, the abolition movement, the civil rights movement, these are the movements that have made this country great. So I slide off to the airport and I miss my plane. Now, so I call up Dennis and I say, Dennis, I've got to get on a plane to Denver. I have this talk to give. I don't know what to do. So he says, just a second. He's on his internet as he always on the internets as he always is. And he pulls up the blueprint of the Rochester airport. And he says, are you in the Susan B. Anthony wing or in the Frederick Douglass wing? I said, oh, come on. Don't fool around. I have to get on a plane. He said, I'm not kidding. So I said, I'm standing in the middle of the airport. And then I see one wing written in the ground of this terminal. It says Susan B. Anthony. And over here is a little plaque and it says Frederick Douglass. You know, every once in a while you have to stop and smell the coffee. So I go, oh, I could go either way, really. And so I got a plane, and I got to Denver. And but that lesson of the movements that have made this country great. And I will end with these two stories. I always like to tell the story of Rosa Parks because it's a story everyone knows. But even that story, the media gets wrong. Yeah. Rosa Parks. We all know she sat down on the bus in Montgomery December 1st, 1955. You might not remember the date or the place, whatever, but you know Rosa Parks' story. She sits down on the bus, refuses to get up for a white passenger. And in so doing, she stands up for all of us, right? Not just African Americans, but for everyone. Because if one person is oppressed, we're all oppressed. And the media tells that part of the story. They might not talk about the oppression part, but they tell pretty much that part of the story. When she died a few years ago, before the big funeral in Detroit, her body lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda, the first African-American woman to lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda. Then they took her body to a Washington church, and thousands of people came out. And we raced down to be there to talk to the people who had come to the church. You know, December 1st, 1955, she sits down in the bus and she launches the modern-day civil rights movement. 4 days later, December 5th, she goes to court and the Montgomery Improvement Association has its meeting and they elect as their leader to lead the boycott that will lead to the desegregation of the transportation system of Montgomery. They elect as their leader a young minister who had just come into town, Dr. Martin Luther King. Rosa Parks helped to launch Dr. Martin Luther King. And the media told the story when she died, but they said that Rosa Parks was a tired seamstress. She was no troublemaker, they said. But that's exactly what Rosa Parks was, a first-class troublemaker. She knew exactly what she was doing when she sat down on that bus. In fact, she'd done it before. She was the secretary of the local NAACP. She worked under E.D. Nixon, or with E.D. Nixon. He was the president of the NAACP. He came out of radical labor politics. He worked with the greatest organizer of the 20th century, A. Philip Randolph, who organized the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. The conductors on the trains, all African American, you know, in the 10s, the 20s, the 30s, descendants of or former slaves themselves. All called George. I didn't say name George. All called George for George Pullman, the Pullman trains. And that's why they had to organize. And they called in a Philip Randolph, remarkable organizer. He organized the 1963 March on Washington. In fact, he befriended Eleanor Roosevelt, and she brought him to meet FDR. And this is an interesting story. In fact, it's one that President Obama told when he was running for president in the backyard in Montclair, New Jersey. You know, when you go from backyard to backyard. I, too, can see the backyard from my house. But he was speaking, and at the end of the evening, someone raised their hand and asked Senator Obama, presidential candidate Obama, what he thought of what his solution was for the Middle East. And he told the story of A. Philip Randolph, who, when Eleanor Roosevelt brought him to FDR, described the situation of working people in this country, of black people in this country, and FDR said to A. Philip Randolph, I don't disagree with anything you've said, but you'll have to make me do it. Make me do it. And that's what Senator Obama said to this person who asked him what to do about the Middle East. Make me do it. So back to A. Philip Randolph's colleague who had helped organize the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, Edie Nixon, who was president of the local NAACP in Montgomery and worked with Rosa Parks to desegregate Montgomery. And they've been doing it for years. She trained at the Highlander Center. King went to the Highlander Center too, black and white together, working to most effectively, strategically change the laws. And she sat down on the bus before December 1st, and so did other young women. But, well, you never know when the magic moment will come. But if you're involved with making social change, you will help lay the foundation for history. And what the media does is it denigrates activists. But what could be more noble than dedicating your life to making the world a better place? And to show how brave Rosa Parks was, just a few months before was the summer of 1955, and that was the summer of Emmett Till, 14-year-old African-American boy, African-American teenager, whose mother, Mamie Till, sent him from Chicago to be with family to get out of the city in the summer, and he ends up being lynched. He was dragged out of bed of his aunt and uncle and cousin's house in the middle of the night by a white mob, and they beat him, and they tortured him, and he ended up in the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. And when his body was dredged up to be sent back to Chicago to his mother, she said she wanted his casket open for the wake and the funeral. She wanted the world to see the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry. Thousands passed by his casket and saw. And then Jet Magazine and other black publications took photographs of his distended, mutilated head. And they published those photographs. And they were seared into the history and consciousness of this country. Mamie Till Mobley, had something very important to teach the press of today. Show the pictures. Show the images. Could you imagine for just 1 week in this country if we saw the images of war? The top, above the fold of every surviving newspaper, the photograph and the article. Of every newscast, radio or television, the top news story. If every homepage page showed the images of war, every TV newscast, the babies dead on the ground, the soldiers dead and dying, the women with their legs blown off by cluster bombs or drones from Pakistan to Afghanistan to Iraq for just 1 week. Americans are a compassionate people. They would say no. War is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. Democracy Now!
Thank you so much, Amy. Amy will be making her way to the back of the theater, to the table in the hall to sign books. And if you could so kindly keep the line to the left door as you exit for people who want to. She's not able to do a question and answer session here, but she's happy to answer questions. You don't have to buy a book to ask her a question. But please do buy a book, get a signed copy. The proceeds go to WGXC. And if you get two books, if you buy two books, you'll get the special DVD that is like some of the best favorite interviews of Democracy Now! Over the years and of Amy's. And you can't buy the CD, you can only get it if you buy two books. So please do so. And thank you so much for coming and being a part of this. And I hope that some of you will join us at Bell's afterwards to hang out and talk. And yeah, thanks so much.